They do not grow old, as we who are left grow old. Age shall not worry them, nor the years condemn. At the breaking of the day and the setting of the sun, we shall remember them. I'm Cindy Wall. Welcome to a special Remembrance Day edition of On the Go. The news and weathers and the notices to mariners will be in their regular spots, but today we're devoting our entire show to the memory of the men and women who fought and died in the wars of this century. They were there at the war memorial in St. John's this morning, just as they were at cenotaphs across the country. Older men and women, standing stiffly against the cold, thin, graying hair, rumpled faces, watery eyes, their thoughts rushing back to a time long ago, but a time that still seems to them like only yesterday.
I was with Gurkhas of the 10th Indian Division in the white sand dunes near Mersa Matru. And when yet again the word came, withdraw. I was with a field regiment of artillery, holding the road near Fuka against two columns of enemy tanks in front, and with the road behind cut by another column. This was at night. There was an inferno in the moonlight. Several enemy tanks were destroyed. His advance was held up. Again, someone said, you'd better get out. Go into the desert while the going is good. Which I did, but they stayed. Our army will fight with that true British courage, which is never more stubborn and sedate than toward the close of a doubtful and murderous day.
That's the CBC's Matthew Halton reporting from Africa in 1942. The people who kept the home fires burning sat glued to the radio night after night as news from the front lines faded in and out on the speaker. On this side of the Atlantic, you got the big picture, reports from all over Europe and Asia on how the war was going. But the men who fought on the front lines never got to see the big picture. They were too busy staying alive. For them, the war was about surviving another day, taking another hill, inching another mile forward. It was about death and fear and the men who fought beside them. Today, we're going to try to give you an idea of what the war was like for the young men who fought it. Hundreds, if not thousands, of Newfoundlanders fought in the Second World War. Harold Lake and Campbell Eaton were just two of them. They're veterans of the 166, the Newfoundland Field Regiment of the Royal Artillery in the British Army. In 1940, Harold was 20 years old, Campbell just 19. They signed up in the first draft and spent the next 5 years in Europe, the first two training in England, the last 3 years fighting their way across Africa and up the length of Italy. For the next 2 hours, they'll tell us their story about the war from their point of view at the front. Here they are in conversation with Harry Brown.
Harold and I were part of what they call an observation post crew. And our role was to get out, maintain communications, either by phone or by wireless, with the guns at all times.
We were up with the infantry, the forward company usually, and our job was to pick out the targets, zero in on them, and shoot and kill whatever we saw or knock out the vehicles.
Okay.
And that was our role.
You hadn't done any of this, of course, in Britain before you left the United Kingdom.
Not in earnest, but in practice, yes. At it all the time, learning how to do it better.
And when did you leave the United Kingdom for North Africa?
We left the United Kingdom in January of 1943, was it?
43, that's right.
Yeah.
Who was the enemy in Africa at the time?
The enemy at that time was the German.
And Italian.
Under Rommel. And they were... With the squeeze was on. The 8th Army was coming from the east through the desert, and we were coming from the west through the mountains of Tunisia and Algeria, Tunisia. And then the squeeze was being put on Rommel. So he was commanding both armies, facing the Eighth Army and facing us.
We landed in Algiers, pushed up the coast to a place called Bone on a little small troop carrying ship, and landed at Bone and pitched on the sand in, and marched in 5 miles, and then waited the orders to get in action. They didn't get the progress in North Africa that they expected. They went so far, and then Rommel was fighting for his life, and Von Arnim and whatever general, and they knocked the British back a bit. And it was just about that time that the Americans arrived on the scene, and I don't know whether you ever heard of a place called Kasserine, but the Americans got a bad beating at a place called the Kasserine Pass, and that meant we almost got cut off.
That battle was between February the 14th, yeah. 43, and February the 22nd was the Battle of Kasserine. And it was sort of like a death throw by the Germans that they could have beaten through, and they gave the Americans a really, really rough time. Remember, we had to go in to just for a couple of days to give them support, got our guns in and gave them some artillery support.
General Patton went in after and had to help sort it out. You know old blood and guts Patton.
Yes. Were you people then working for Patton at any time?
Well, very briefly. You know, we would never know really who we were working for at the top level. That was something that information that we rarely got in any great detail.
So but this was the first action you saw.
Yeah, but the first action after Bone, we got in. We waited for our vehicles. Some of our vehicles got torpedoed, and our guns and whatnot. And you know, the British Army had convoys going in, and we were lucky, I suppose, to get there without a scratch. We came over on a troop ship. There were thousands of people. We were down the bottom. If anything had ever happened, I always felt we would have never made it.
We came on a ship called the HMT Circassia. And the HMT being Her Majesty's transport, and she was set up as a troop ship, and we went via the Bay of Biscay through the Straits of Gibraltar into Algiers. In Algiers, we then transferred to two small ships called the Princess Beatrix and the Queen Wilhelmina.
Well, yeah.
There were two Dutch ships.
And a former chief of police was a sailor on it.
By the name of Brown, would you believe?
yes.
John Brown. He was
That's
the
right.
chief officer. And he
You're
was a petty officer in the Navy. And going down over the gangplank, the first fellow I met, because I knew him because he lived around the corner from me on Cookstown Road.
Yeah.
And he was there at the bottom of the gangway when we went aboard. So we ran the gauntlet down because, you know, the Germans had control of the air in those days. And we ran the gauntlet down to Bone and walked off the ship right onto the sidewalk because the harbor was wrecked in Bone. And then, as Harold said, we marched then 5 miles up to the big camp we thought we were going to go into, and this turned out to be just a pile of sand.
Dive bombed that night by Italian bombers and fighters. Big air battle over where we were.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were then in the midst of action.
Finding that war had really started.
Were there any Newfoundland casualties up to this point?
Not up to this point, no.
When did the first happen?
They happened, there was a fellow by the name of Flynn. And there was, I got a list of them here, as a matter of fact. The ones together.
But the real tragedy
Flynn and Winter and Snow.
Yeah.
And they were killed on a, well, Winter and Snow were killed on a Bren gun carrier that was coming back from an observation post and ran over a landmine and threw the bloody thing upside down. And it was lucky there was seven people in that thing, Bren gun carrier being a tracked vehicle.
Yes.
Frank Sims, who was here, was in that vehicle. He is now retired, and he was very much in that thing. When we were talking about it up on the Gander River this summer. Mm-hmm. And but they were the first ones killed. And Jim Winter, whose brother Norman was just retired as Commissioner of Red Cross.
Yeah. Now,
but that was the first position area. We went up and joined a French corps. That was our first role. It was with Frenchmen. They were Gooms and Moroccans and a motley bunch. But that was our first role. And I remember the first hill that I was with an officer then by the name of Bill Black. And the first hill we took over, the Americans, every one of them, had been killed and buried in their trenches on the hill. It was near Kasserine. And I thought it was an awful grim sight. And the first shells were falling, and, you know, your mortars and shells. But that was the first taste that I had, was on this hill which had been the British. We had taken it back, and we were put there to support and defend that hill with the Frenchmen on a pass that was going to our immediate right.
And that was the first time that you were under fire where people were actually shooting at you?
Yes, first time.
Yeah. How'd you feel?
I felt funny to start with because it was I was fascinated to a degree. But then I felt myself, well, they're trying to kill me. And then I started to get scared. And then I took precautions because we were trained to dig in and the enemy, you know, is out to kill you and your job is to try and survive. There's all kinds of mortars, machine gun coming in. And, you know, I'm only 20 or something. I'm frightened to death. Jeez, here I am trying to defend a hill. Anyway, I knew what I had to do. And although we had been given instructions not to fire, only in an emergency, because the flash of our guns were so near that it would give away our position. But I didn't fool around about that. I fired, and I fired and killed a lot of people. I shouldn't tell the story, but it gave me a great confidence in myself and the guns.
You must have had people trained so well, corporals, captains, that you could rely absolutely on what they told you.
No question. No question about that at all. In fact, you were so well trained that you did everything almost automatically. And it had to be that way, because when you got in action and the, you know, the actual front end of that fighting machine, you had to do things automatically because, as Harold says, you know, there's a certain amount of, you're scared during this process, but you're also very busy. And but if you were not that well trained, you would never be able to do the things. You had to think things through. In other words, you almost do things without thinking.
Yeah.
You do it by rote, you know, and it's done quickly and done well. And every person, six men on a gun crew, and every one of those six had a specific job to do. And they did it well, you know,
well trained
automatically. In the observation post, each fellow had a job to do. And he did it well. The two people responsible for the control of the fire was the OP officer, or the OP ACK is called it, in other words, assistant. Then the others in the OP with you were communications fellows, signalers we call them. And their job was to make sure that if I called or he called for fire, that they automatically put that thing, there was a certain system that you used, and you'd give the orders to that signaler, he would pass it through to the guns, and the guns then would respond.
Okay, so this was how it was done.
That's how it was done.
Now, what did you do? You left that first battle within hours, days.
That was at a place called Jebel Bargu.
Yeah, that wasn't Jebel a battle. That was a night skirmish. That was a bunch of, as it happens, an infantry battalion of Germans that, so the information came to us, came out to take back this hill and to control that pass, because Rommel was coming in and the avenues of breaking through and getting at the British Army then, he was fighting for his life. So that was a vital hill, as it happened. I happened to be on it.
It's interesting that you met the police officer who lived around the corner
from that
business. I mean, I wonder if when you were over there in this situation, Harold Lake, that you looked at Lieutenant Goodridge.
Yeah.
Did it occur to you while you were talking to him and he was talking to you that, oh, yeah, I remember Harold Lake lived over in La March. Oh, yeah, this is, Goodridge lived wherever. You know, did that was this part of your relationship
yes.
at all,
well,
or was
exactly.
it all brand new?
It's interesting in that, you know, there's a, in order to maintain discipline, I might just answer that, Harry, in the sense of, because Harold and I knew each other before the war. But do you know that we had, 2.5 years together?
Yeah, in Italy.
In Italy. Part of Africa and then Italy. And I as the troop commander, and Harold as my right-hand man in this whole thing, and we never once called each other by a first name until we came back here and landed in St. John's. Yet the relationship couldn't have been closer. Couldn't have worked
Sleeping.
Better.
You were captain.
Yes, but you had to maintain a certain discipline.
If you didn't.
Know?
And
you
we
couldn't
were trained
relax.
That way.
And we're trained that way. And everybody
discipline.
Accepted it, you know?
You got to remember, we're 2 years in Britain, training and discipline. And you just
almost.
Don't go along and say, well, Clem, how are you getting on?
That's right. That's right. You wouldn't do that.
It's not done.
Take us through Africa now, from there.
Okay. Well, from there, I guess the big battle of Africa, and Harold can tell you more about, I was on the gun end during that campaign.
In a different battery.
Battery. That was before I was promoted. And my role, then we moved up north in Tunisia to a place that became known, quite famous in history now, as Longstop Hill. And that was probably the, well, not probably, it was no question the biggest single battle that was fought in Africa on the First Army side. And my role was on the guns and it, working out all program of firing, which the big attack was coming in, and we had an extensive planned program to be developed. We developed all this in the field. And also we're responsible for having the guns properly placed, properly online, and calibrated, everything ready to go. And the night that they came in to the gun position, the quads or the gun towers coming in around the gun position ran over some mines. And geez, we had three of them blew up. And fortunately, nobody was hurt in them because we had sandbags on the floors of the vehicles so that everything just jumped. But the vehicles were destroyed. So that gave us our first, and that was after dark. And we had to have them in and ready to fire by first light the next morning, which meant you had we had a pretty damn busy night of them in the gun position. But now Harold had a more vivid experience in that he was up at the observation post with the infantry, I think the Grenadier Guards or one of the
Grenadier Guards. We went in with the Grenadier Guards the next morning, forward of our barrage. And I have never witnessed such a day in all my life. The guards were tremendous, disciplined, brave officers, and we crawled and scraped our way up the hill because they fought and mortared us and whatnot. I don't want to get into all the details. But finally, we couldn't get to the pillbox on the top of the hill, which was holding up the whole thing. And the guards officer and three grenadiers rushed it. The officer got killed, two of the grenadiers and one fellow got wounded, and we finally captured that final point in Longstop Hill.
So you were almost, you were like infantry.
Oh, absolutely. Personally. No doubt. Matter of fact, people say I was in the artillery, but I spent an awful lot of time, like Camden in Italy, most of the time with the infantry. It was a dirty job.
Pretty well.
Your life expectancy wasn't very much. That's the job we had. It was very fascinating, very interesting, and of course very frightening at times. But anyway, they took Longstop Hill. Because I remember when we got to this final strong point, and I was there with Captain Black, and then we saw the Germans in a road coming in to reinforce them. And we brought down a regimental target on a section of road where a motorized German division were coming in, and we hammered them. They never made it. Our regiment, the 166th Regiment, certainly made up for Bowman Hamill.
Did you consciously really think of Beaumont Hamill?
I didn't then, but I thought about it a few times. A funny thing, I was getting a little dirty with the Germans, and they were disrupting our lives. We'd been in Africa, and they were doing, you know, we were out to sort of get them out of the way. They were disrupting the world. You think about your family, you think that you may not make it. You think about life you haven't lived really enough. I mean, I was scared a lot. Don't fool yourself about that.
The other thing, too, we got to remember here again, going back to training, you know, that the training under Colonel Lambert was pretty bloody rigid. We wondered whether the guy was all there when we were going through this sort of thing.
No quarter.
And it was when we got into the battle, it only took the first day to realize that all the things that man beat into our heads, and beat in, I mean, because we couldn't understand what the hell he was up to. And when we got there, and did all the things automatically that he had taught us. That's what saved the lives.
That's what saved us.
Jeez, I mean, you get as soon as you got in, the first thing you did was dig, get your gun dug in, then you dig a hole for yourself, you know, before you ate or before you did anything.
Yeah. And you're jumping from one place to another and trying to survive and leaving one trench, running to another, and the trench you leave gets a direct hit. And you've just missed it, you know, and then you wonder where you're going if you're not going to be the next hit. It's a very mobile warfare.
There's one thing in those kind of situations that you're so bloody busy for those moments that you don't have time to be scared.
To think about yourself.
You know?
Okay.
Just can't get time to get scared.
Take us along. A Longstop Hill now is accomplished. What happened?
Now, this is where the big breakthrough came to the plains around in Tunis itself, in the area of Tunis.
It's a vivid day.
It's not something you forget.
No, I have nightmares and I think about it quite often. I never forget it, no.
You were wounded, Harold?
Yes.
Badly?
No, not seriously. I got wounded in the arm and my face, and it looked bad, but it wasn't as bad as it looked. Black got a piece of shrapnel in his back, and I got a piece on my arm. I still have it there, actually, and in around my eye. And
well, they sent you to a hospital?
Yes, that was vivid. I got carried back and on a Bren gun carrier, which Richard drove back through to the... We took the first wounded off the hill. And then when I got back to a field place, a fellow gave me a needle and whatnot, and I got knocked out. I woke up the next morning to what I call a nunnery in behind the lines, and all I could hear was 'twas Easter Sunday morning. This battle took place on Easter Saturday.
1943.
That's right.
Good
and
Friday.
I woke up in the morning in a stretcher with Germans and everybody and the bells ringing. You know what I thought? I thought I was in heaven.
Harold Lake and Campbell Eaton are veterans of the Newfoundland Artillery Regiment, the 166. After the regional news from Africa to Italy and the long march north, I'm Cindy Wall, and you're listening to a special Remembrance Day edition of On the Go.
With anyone else but me, anyone else but me, anyone else but me. No, 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 don't sit under the apple tree with anyone else but me till I come marching home. Don't go walking down Lover's Lane with anyone else but me, anyone else but me, anyone else but me. No, 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 don't go walking down Lover's Lane with anyone else but me till I come marching home. I just got word from a girl who heard from the girl next door to me. The boy she met just loves to pet and it fits you to a T. So don't sit under the apple tree with anyone else but me till I come marching home. Sit under the apple tree with anyone else but me, with anyone else but her. No, 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 not a single soul but me. No, 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 don't you sit under the apple tree with anyone else but me. Not till you see me, not until you see me marching home. Home, 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 sweet home. Don't go up and down Lover's Lane with anyone else but me, with anyone else but her. No, 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 not a single soul but me. No, 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 don't you go walking down Lover's Lane with anyone else but me. Not till you see me, not until you see me marching home. Home, 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 sweet home. Just wait till I come marching home. Marching home, then we'll go arm in arm and sit down under the apple tree, baby, just you and me. When I come marching home.
And those were the Andrews sisters with "Don't Sit Under the Apple Tree with Anyone Else But Me." Well, you're listening to a special CBC Remembrance Radio. Day edition of On the Go. I'm Cindy Wall in Happy Valley Goose Bay. Coming up, we'll have a look at the weather for the island and Labrador, and we'll have part two of our conversation with Harold Lake and Campbell Eaton. Right now, the regional news is next. It's 5 o'clock, 4:30 in Labrador. Well, you're listening to a special Remembrance Day edition of On the Go. Coming up, finishing the fight in Africa and the start of the long march through Italy with Harold Lake, Campbell Eaton, and Harry Brown.
It was a small action compared to what is to come. Yet for an hour, the world shook with the cannonade. Shells from our guns behind us screamed over toward the enemy, like demon express trains. Enemy shells shrieked viciously toward us and exploded. Machine guns stuttered harshly. Tanks went clanking and lumbering across the rocky desert. And bombs from our Hudsons exploded among enemy concentrations in full sight. We saw enemy transport burning, and great columns of smoke and sand rose in lazy majesty into the air before the sound of the explosions reached us. In the sky, British and enemy fighters wheeled and dived like silver hawks, and occasionally one came crashing down to land or sea in a long, dreadful moan. The scene was infernal, yet merely the prelude of the concerto soon to come, when our determined and clever enemy launches everything he's got.
That's Matthew Halton from 1942. He was traveling with the British Army as they fought their way across Africa. Somewhere amongst the hundreds of thousands of men in that army were a few hundred Newfoundlanders and Labradorians. Two of them were Harold Lake and Campbell Eaton. They were at the front as artillery observers in the Newfoundland Artillery Regiment, the 166. Their job was to guide the big guns as they rained shells down on the enemy and sometimes themselves. Everyone who fought in the war has their own story to tell. These are just two of them. Here's Campbell Eaton.
For the next couple of weeks, it was a cleanup operation to about the 5th or 6th of May, when all of the Germans were corralled in and put in different POW camps around Carthage and the coast of Tunis. And then we pulled back and went back to a place called Satif in the mountains of Algeria to regroup, repair, rebuild our equipment, and generally maintain and get ready for the next round. We were there until September, thereabout. And in September, we were asked to go to Tripoli, which was, 2,000 miles away. And in October, we loaded the guns aboard two transport ships and the troops aboard, I guess, two or three landing craft infantry run by the Americans at a place called Philippeville. And we set sail for Italy with a brief stop off at in Sicily at Catania for one day, and then on to Taranto, which is in the heel of the boot, if you like, of Italy. Interesting, when we got in there, we went through a lot of minefields and so on, but when we got in Toronto, it's one of the most vivid things was, you probably heard of that great attack that was done by aircraft called a Swordfish, I think it was, when they went in, when the Italian fleet, they didn't know whether they were going to get it out of Toronto or not. They went in and flew right into the harbor and bombed and knocked all these things out, and here's some of these ships on their side and what have you. It was kind of an interesting sight to see. Now, we hadn't heard much about that because we weren't that well informed of what the big war was all about, with, due to lack of radio communication and so on with the outside world, for us, who were so quite isolated. But anyway, there we gathered, our guns arrived with us there, and we went over outside of Toronto about 20 miles and got everything together. And then we headed north along the east coast of Italy, through Bari and Foggia, up to a place called San Severo, where we rested for a day or two, and then on up to, what the hell was the name of that first river, the one before the Sangro?
Trigno.
Trigno. And there we started, and it was the first time that Harold and I and the team we had worked together as a sort of as a crew for, you know, getting into the wars themselves, and our first exposure there was with the 8th Indian Division. Anyway, we started off with them, and we ran into our first encounter with the Germans, and we were told that the Germans were holding things up. Would we bring fire down? Would you go forward? And as I remember, Will French and I, he was our signal sergeant, went forward with a small radio on his back.
On a motorbike.
And we rushed ahead to get up with the leading company. And then we were mortared. I lost control of the motorbike. We both finished up upside down in a ditch. Radio was beaten up. And fortunately, neither of us were hurt. Left the motorbike there, only to find that the infantry weren't as far ahead as we were told they were. So we had to come back. But however, we did spot where the Germans were.
Cam, and if I may interrupt, went farther forward and saw the Germans holding the ridge. He went and bashed down beyond the call of duty, I'd like to say.
Well, I wouldn't say that.
Well, he did.
The infantry weren't as far ahead as we were told.
No, and he got a little ahead, but he saw the Germans. And, of course, brought down the fire on the ridge and knocked the Germans off the ridge.
We had to come back first.
I think this is where he got his military cross.
Where was that?
Place called Furci, F-U-R-C-I.
And that's where you got the military cross?
Well, I don't know.
Well, I'm pretty sure he did. That's where it was. That's where I heard it was, yeah. But I want to tell you this before you get a little beyond that. The Germans were fighting a rear guard delaying action. And they picked dominant ridges and places to defend, whereby it took a handful of Germans some time to defend the ridge, sometimes several companies, whereas it took a battalion to take that.
Right.
You understand?
Yes.
And then when they fought the delaying action, then when they felt at nightfall that things were grim and you got knocked out and whatnot, then they pulled out completely.
They were trying to get their main army out of it.
Yes, but well, they picked
through this winter line.
They picked their line in this particular delaying action up to the River Sangro.
Then we got word that the infantry had moved on across a big valley and up the side of a hill. Now, we had no roads in this area at all. So, geez, we had to get our stuff up there somehow. So we commandeered a local mule from one of the local farmers. Well, no, mules are trained to do the job, too.
Very, very, very necessary.
So we loaded all this heavy equipment, batteries, and the big radio set. In those days, I mean, you know, a thing to communicate 7 miles was like this, you see.
A big, heavy piece of radio
equipment
that
today
would fit in a handbag.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. You put it in your, you know, your arse pocket.
Right.
And we got this mule in the kitchen of this house. It was priceless to watch the crew. Getting all this stuff packed up on the mule's back, tying it down. We didn't have a clue how to, you know, pack a mule. Fellas were trained for that, but we weren't trained for that. Anyway, we got it all on. And poor old Bill Olford, as Harold said, died last year. Mm. He was the muleteer, they call him. Lead this bloody mule, you know. And we got down the bottom of the valley. Hadn't started up the bloody hill yet. Down the bottom of the valley, and the whole load came under the mule. The mule lay down and wouldn't get up.
Not easy.
So we had to pick up every piece that was there, the whole crew, and carry it up over this bloody mountain, see. So, you know, you got to be very careful when you're telling these stories. You know, I sound like you're, geez, nobody else in the bloody war but you,
yeah,
you know.
Well, you must have felt that occasionally, though.
Well, you were there. You had a very small role, you know, I mean, when I say small, in sense of front,
yeah,
you know.
I understand.
You didn't know what was going on a mile and a half or 2 miles to the right or to the left of you half the time.
Were there any casualties in Italy up to this point?
No, not at this point.
There were one or two, I believe, yeah. But not serious.
But anyway, we got up to, if I might just say, we got across, got up this observation post, and we had a farmer, a young fellow in the farm, lived in this farmhouse we were in, called Lino. And he was a two-way character in that he was bringing message to the Germans and coming back and giving us, which was, I don't think was right information. And anyway, he lived with us, literally, and we thought we were doing a great thing by him and he for us. And we were with the Sikhs by this time, switch of battalions. Mm-hmm. And anyway, our guns were going to move, and they came out of action, and we were going to change over 2 or 3 days later. It was a real rough deal we had going.
And he knew we were changing over,
this little fellow,
you understand?
So they came in, the Germans came in with a counterattack. And, geez, our guns were on the road, so we had to call for them and jump in, come off the road, get in action. And the only way we could do it quickly, and for them to understand, they had their maps all marked where we were. So we gave our position as the target, and we added a couple of hundred yards on to that after they worked out the range, you know.
We sent, Cam sent all the other stuff off.
Our stuff was gone.
With a mule and with the fellas. Mm-hmm. And he, as his act, he said, "Now, Bombardier Lake, you stay with me and we'll be the last, you know." So I stayed behind with him. I don't want to say what I did, but as it happens, we were both left on this place, and I had a little telephone. And when the fire came, the Germans got in around the farmhouse where we were, but we brought down the fire and told the infantry to take cover and whatnot, because it was literally Cam brought it down on top of ourselves. I don't think he ever got the credit for it, but I certainly saw it, with Cam out with his revolver and myself with a Tommy gun and poking around out where it was not a very healthy place.
Again, you know, you aren't scared at the time, you're scared after.
How old were you then?
22.
And just you were a captain?
23.
You captain?
Yeah, yes.
Captain. Oh. MC.
Had the military cross at that stage.
Yeah.
At 22 years of age.
23.
Yeah. 23 years of age. Making decisions which, for that part of the war, changed the course of events.
Well, yes. To that particular area, yes. Yeah, that immediate area. You know.
You're only a small part of an army. But that little area where we were, that was our war.
Let's move us along up the up the boot.
So anyway, we did get out of that then. Then we moved up into the Sangro River area, which was really, I suppose, one of the major battles of the war, getting across Sangro River to cut the road from a place called Ortona on the coast to... Mazzagronia.
Mazzagronia, yeah. We call it Mazzagragna.
Yeah, and Orsonia.
Newfoundlanders did, yeah.
Mazzagragna, yeah. And there we had some casualties on crossing that river. White was killed and, I know, one or two others. Then Harold and I got separated there for some reason.
Well, you got something knee or tonsils or something.
I had to go to hospital, yeah. That's right. I had to go to hospital. I got a case of tonsillitis and had to go to hospital. And geez, by the time I got to the hospital, I was better. But it took so long to get there. Mm. But while there's an interesting episode while I was in hospital. At 2 o'clock in the morning, came in, woke me up and said, "You got to get out." I said, "What do you mean you got to get out? I haven't seen a doctor yet." "No, you got to leave. You got to leave." I said, "Why?" And we heard this bombing going on, but you didn't pay much attention to bombing. You know, really, it wasn't on you. Anyway, this was a night in Barry Harbor when there was 19 ships arrived from Britain carrying shells and food and you name it. And one lone Stuka dive bomber came in and hit an ammunition ship in the harbor, and it blew up. And geez, when it blew up, all the rest was like a sequence of events. Went right
didn't
around.
They have gas as well, wasn't there?
And anyway, what happened was when these things blew up, the patients were being brought in from the casualties were being brought into the hospital. And they didn't know it, but there was a tanker of mustard gas that blew up. And geez, people dived in the harbor. And all the nurses, because they didn't know what it was, got mustard gas burns in their hands, and they weren't prepared for it, see?
This is British mustard gas.
Oh,
yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Oh, I'll tell you.
Preparing in case of...
We carried 4 rounds per gun of mustard gas shells, just in case the Germans, you know, used the mustard gas against us.
Mm.
And they had tankers loads of mustard gas in Italy. You know, for the same reason. They had all the equipment. If the Germans went to a gas war, we were ready.
And the only time they were used was in Barry Harbor when it was blown up by a Stuka bomber.
That's
right.
That's right, which was fortunate. And anyway, I joined another crew then when I got back from the hospital and went across the river and had a very interesting experience, two interesting experiences there in that we were with the Gurkha Battalion and we went into this house at night. And we established our observation post in the, it was a 3.5-story house, I remember, right up in the attic when we got all our equipment up, our radio, the works. And in the morning at first light, we were all wide awake, 4:30 in the morning, looking out over the front. And we heard a single shot fired downstairs, you know, and I said to Will French at the time, "What the hell, who the hell was that?" He said, "I don't know." So then a minute or two later, there was a burst of Tommy gun, a second burst of Tommy gun. So Joe Bennett was downstairs and shouted out to me, come down, quick. And this was a first aid post, the Germans had. And there were 16 of them in this basement that we walked by them all night long bringing our stuff up. And they never stirred. And in the morning, one of the Germans called out to the Gurkha and said, "Johnny, come here," which everybody called the Gurkhas Johnny. And he went there, and this German, like a bloody fool, took a shot at him and missed. And he went out and got his Tommy gun. He was washing, stripped to the waist, this little Gurkha. Went in, and geez, he riddled right around. Killed them all but one.
And killed the, all but one?
All but one. Found him in a wine barrel. And when I came down, there were five Gurkhas around with their cookeries out, you know? And when they take their cookeries out, they got to draw blood.
These are the knives.
And that's right. And there's one time in my life, my geez, I tell you, I was really scared. I frightened to death. They were going to slice him up, you know. And anyway, they listened to a British officer, these Indians, I tell you, and I told them to go away. So anyway, I got the Luger that this fellow had, which is now down in the Royal Newfoundland Regiment Museum. And we sent him back. I got his picture, same guy. And we sent him back, and he had a wound on his shin. But that episode, you know, is recorded in the Gurkha history, that little episode. Not named. I'm not named in there, anybody. You refer to the artillery officer.
I heard a story that the Gurkhas would do this kind of exercise routinely, that they would go into a pillbox or an encampment or a unit and kill all but one.
All but one. That's right. There's a story about that, too, with the same group.
And know. The idea was so that there would be one survivor to tell how terrifying it was to be attacked by Gurkhas. Is that
propaganda? One story they told about the same as the 5th Gurkha Battalion, about how an officer patrol, which consisted of an officer and his batman, went forward to this lateral road that we're going to talk a bit more about. And the batman went one way and the officer went the other, and they were to meet back at 3 o'clock at the road junction. At 4 o'clock, the little Gurkha still hadn't turned up, and the officer's getting pretty wicked. When he turned up, he raised hell and he said, "What the hell were you doing?" And he said, "Well, sir, I found a slit trench, and there's 3 Germans in it, sound asleep." He said, "Well, I hope you killed them all." He said, "No, sir, I killed the 2 outside fellas. I'd love to see the face of the other fella when he woke up." You know,
yeah,
but they're really, really marvelous little fellas, those Gurkhas. I mean, they're
You were artillery support
for them at that time.
Yes.
Yeah. In that same thing there, now, we were in this village across this river, and we slept overnight in some of the houses. At breakfast that morning, I said to the fellas, "Well, look, we better get the hell out of here and get out into a field somewhere." And we got out in the field, and we dug slit trenches. And Harry, I couldn't believe it. By 11 o'clock that morning, or 10 o'clock, beautiful day, 3 dive bombers came in, Germans, came out of the sun, which you couldn't see them. You came down, absolutely flattened that village, killed everybody in it, including some of our own troops who stayed around in there. But the worst thing, you know, didn't affect us so much then, but it has with me ever since. I see what's going on in Yugoslavia now, and I can't believe that people don't have enough sense not to do it. But the kids and the women and the, you know, and the fathers and mothers of people that were killed like that is just, you know, absolutely atrocious. It's unbelievable.
Under any criteria, could it have been described as a military target for those
pilots?
Yes,
because we were there. We were there. And unfortunately, civilians in the front line were given
no.
There's no holds barred. And it was just awful. Usually they, you know, you got an opportunity to get them out of there before the battle started. They'd either go with the Germans or come back behind us, whichever.
They had a sense of moving at the right time.
But, you know, this is a thing in war that people forget. You know, you talk about us as soldiers and, you know, into this thing and so on, and we're trained to deal with that situation. But it's unbelievable. You know, you see this stuff, we're digressing a little bit now, but this Yugoslav thing really brings it home. What you see on television is not what you get. And it just appears to be. What you see on television is more like a show. But what you got to hear and what you got to see, and what you got to get the smell of the thing, you got to have the screeching of the kids, the screeching of the families, the grown-ups, you know, the absolute fear that goes on.
That have no
You don't
part
get
of
that
war.
On television. But geez, when I watch this stuff in Yugoslavia now on television, I just practically throw up, you know.
This is Matthew Halton of the CBC speaking from Italy. Here is a recording made today on the Sangro River battlefront. I am speaking from a British observation post above the Sangro River. Immediately below us, there is a perfect view of a battle. There's lots to see, and there's been a great deal to see all morning. The German shells, you can hear our own shells now, our own guns. The German shells at the moment are falling on our forward positions. Our own guns are cracking away, and our aircraft
are strafing the enemy positions on the high escarpment beyond. And our bombers have been at it since dawn. They go over in squadrons, a squadron at a time. Sometimes we can easily see their bombs leave the aircraft. And when their bombs drop, there are mountains of black smoke so that they obscure the mountains.
We'd like to know what you think of our Remembrance Day special. Please call our talkback answering machine with your comments. The number is 576-5107, and as always, you can call collect. Coming up, we'll have the marine weather and the notices to mariners, but in about 10 minutes, we'll return to the third part of our story with Campbell Eaton, Harold Lake, and Harry Brown.
There, you can hear. Those were the bombs dropping from a squadron of our aircraft. There were two squadrons?
Yes.
I could only see one. And now we can hardly see the mountains beyond. The beautiful Mount Mayella, many miles away, is completely obscured by the huge mountainous black smoke clouds rising from the ridge just beyond the village of Santa Maria. It's quiet now for a second. Below us, not more than a mile away, is the river, lined with yellow Lombardy poplars and oaks that are turning red. It looks very peaceful down there now, but a few minutes ago, our tanks were crossing. We saw them crossing a bridge under quite heavy German fire. I think we've got quite a lot across.
It's 1943. By now, Harold Lake and Campbell Eaton, like all the other men from Newfoundland and Labrador, have been away from home for years. The Newfoundland Artillery Regiment has fought its way across Africa and halfway up the length of Italy. Here is Harry Brown.
Okay, so let's move along now.
Where are we now? Sangro River?
We're past the Sangro River.
Yeah.
We're getting up to Lanciano now.
Well, Lanciano is the lateral road, the break of that, and then Harold and I were together on this lateral road in the breakthrough. And there we had to go in a barrage. I suppose it's a good place to tell the story about the barrage.
Yeah. Mm.
The we put down a divisional, or many divisional, fire plan to help the Canadians who were on our right.
And I think you must explain that we're with the Royal West Kents, and we're trying to get relieve the situation at a town called Ortona, where the Canadians are having a terrible battle. And our role, as I understand, with the 8th Indian Division, is to cut a lateral road.
Now, they had a fire plan.
Separate from
the fire plan consisted of a barrage, and the barrage would lift it 100 yards every so many minutes, and you knew when it was lifted because the sound of the shells wasn't quite as fierce. They'd go up 100, 200 yards or whatever. And so then you had to get up and run, you know, until the next lot came down, then went on again. But we had a situation where one gun, fortunately it wasn't ours, we didn't know that at the time, was falling short by about 200 or 300 yards. One gun, and out of all the guns were firing, maybe 400 or 500 guns. And this bloody thing kept falling short, and the Royal West Kents were running ahead, you know. And in the course of it took about an hour, this whole attack, which when we got to the other end of it, we picked up these Germans sitting around their tanks having breakfast, for God's sake, you know.
Panzer grenadiers.
Stripped off, washing, and, you know. Now, mind you, they weren't doing that when we got there because they were all under their tanks, what have you. But after it was all over, in that late afternoon, that one bloody gun killed 7 of the Royal West Kents. And the CO of the Royal West Kents said to me, "Gunner, come here." So, geez, I'm a captain now, and he's a lieutenant colonel. So we go over, and they had these 7 bodies, boy, it'll live with me till I die, laid out in a row, all British soldiers. And he said, "You did that," you know, meaning the artillery as a whole, but it looked like it was a personal attack.
It happened
at that time. And what an investigation there was about this whole thing. Anyway, some months later, they went through every gun program, and they identified the gun, and it wasn't one of ours. Yeah. And that was quite a relief.
We had, by the way, from our guns point of view, we had some excellent, what they call, artificers. Newfoundlanders, one particularly fellow I think about, we visited him the other afternoon, a fellow Ron Dix, who we used to call him, his name was, we called him Fitter. He was a gun fitter. But that caliber of man, that type of man, his gun and the calibration and the firing of the gun was a very vital thing to us.
Yes.
Because
right.
One gun falling short when a fellow accused him. But that happens in war. It happened in the Gulf War. In Britain, I think the American plane killed some British chaps.
Yes, British tanks. Yeah.
And I think they went over to see President Bush about it.
They've had some conversations about that. Yeah. I know.
Yeah. Anyway, go ahead.
Now we're in the middle, are we? We're
still on the East Coast.
The end of 1944, though.
Yeah, we're up to
December 44?
Christmas Day.
Yeah.
Of 44. And we were in the line fighting on Christmas Day. I remember it was a snowy, wet, miserable day and as we crossed that lateral road. Now, what the hell happened after that? Then we moved across country over to Casino. To the Volturno River. Well, that's where we got prepared for it and so on. And then we eventually brought our guns into action in a town, in front of a town called Cervaro. And this town was about 4 miles from the monastery. In the town of Casino,
with full view.
The guns were in full view of the monastery and so on. And our particular battery was given a role to put our guns, what they call the upper register, fired like a mortar. In other words, the shells would go up and
elevation.
Yeah, and come down, because nobody could get behind
the monastery
walls. You see, so then they called on our crew then to go and observe the fire, and here's where we had a really interesting episode. We had to drive up to the town of Casino, just to the right by the railway station.
In this brand
and
carry.
Go across the Leary River. And they had a very short, now remember this was March by this time, late February. Oh, March. Yes. Yeah, March the 19th was when Vesuvius erupted, yes. Anyway, Harold was driving the Bren gun carrier, and being artillery, the Germans were a very precise people. They did things the same way all the time.
Orderly.
For instance, harassing fire on this bridge, that we had to cross. And they'd have one every 20 seconds, a shell.
Bailey Bridge.
Every 20 seconds. So we knew this, So we stopped the Bren gun carrier.
Walk up.
The shell landed. We took off across the bridge. We were just across the bridge. Another shell.
20 seconds later.
Down, right down behind.
So, and everybody else was going, keeping on. Jesus, people were getting hit unnecessarily, Anyway, we then drove around the back of the mountain, and they had built, the 4th Indian Division had built a road you'd never believe. It was like building a road from the battery to Cabot Tower in a loop around.
The outside of the
On the road. Outside of the hill. Mm. And they built this narrow road. It was just all rock and no gravel on it or anything like that. And the bloody Bren gun carrier, the grade must have been 15% grade anyway, going up. And every now and then, Harold would have to stop. She'd steam and
boil
over and so on. Now, and the noise of the engine, you couldn't hear, the mortaring. But when we'd stopped and let the thing cool off, you'd hear the swish. And this is the bloody mortar bombs going
trying to get us, you see.
But it was so steep, unless they got a direct hit. They couldn't hit you. And we never got a direct hit, so we're here, so we didn't get the direct hit. So we established an observation post right up on the top of the hill, and it was very exposed all around, and there wasn't enough room but for one person, so I had to be the person. And all I could do was build a little rock wall around, not for protection, but so you couldn't be seen.
You had to do this in dark.
And I had a French soldier with me. Jeez, and I couldn't communicate with him. He couldn't speak English, and I couldn't speak French, so we were a great pair. And he lay on the ground with his rifle and keeping an eye on. Anyway, we fired the guns, and it just didn't work. What happened when a shell is spinning, it goes, and as long as it's spinning from the rifling, it'll go in direction. But and also the firing mechanism in the shell, there's a little shutter in the side of the firing mechanism. That's when it's spinning, it stays open. Centrifugal force keeps it open. But once the spin stops, it closes. This thing went up so high, the spinning stopped, the shutter closed, and then bloody things just tumbled down, and none of them exploded. Oh. But we could hear them.
We could see the Germans.
Boom, you know. Yeah. I see the Germans out there. Sure. It was terrible.
All around
washing their
all
clothes.
All around the hill, on the back of his
monastery. Drying their blankets, which and was all the mule trains coming up and with ammunition and so on.
He's running
and
over
things. We couldn't do
lightly.
A thing about it.
It was an awful area, Harry, of death and destruction and slaughter of German and Americans and British all over the place with mules blown up, and it was an awful sight. Now, this particular little hole in the ground where he was every day, I was about 20 yards behind on a phone, you understand, with a line out to him. Now, one day, they're out to spot us, you understand, and to see us. And, of course, they must have known. He shelled the area and mortared, and he got knocked out and never got a scratch. You were knocked
concussion.
Out for how long?
Oh, geez, 4 or 5 hours, I suppose.
Really? Concussion, yeah.
And
did
I was there,
to hospital?
And the Frenchman took off.
Frenchman took off.
When I came to, I was lying there all alone. It's just like I had an electric shock. My hair was standing straight up, for the dust and the dirt.
Every day,
I just had concussion.
He went out, and I went out up in darkness to this particular spot. Me so many yards behind, he in the trench with the Frenchman. And all that area, there was a lot of rock. There was no soil that you could dig down, you understand? And in the nighttime, we went back to this farm, of which they had taped, and they must have seen us coming. I know they did. And the first night we were there, they shelled this old broken-down shell and put, I don't know how many shells to the roof. In
the farm.
Next room, every fellow was killed, and Bennett and Richards and you and I never got a scratch.
Never got a scratch. One interesting thing there, I might just put in here. Up in the OP one morning, in this little place at Casino, the 19th of March, 1944, I saw an explosion about due south of where we were, and sent a message back saying, what the hell was it? Looks like the airport in Naples, which was 60 miles away, is being bombed. That was what I could observe looking at my map and so on. See? And about 6 hours later, I got a message back to say that Vesuvius had just erupted. Jesus. And that's what I saw from up there, this great yellow fire, orange fire.
We all remembered vividly going up there. I happened to be driving this Bren gun carrier. But about 10 years ago, Cam came to me one morning, and he says, been on my mind a bit. He said, we had an awful time at Casino, he said, getting up there. But he said, I don't remember coming down. No, I said, look, I scratched my head. My God, I said, come to think of it, you paid me $1 million, neither do I. So I called this chap, Joe Bennett. He was living in Embree at the time. Phone, Joe. Joe, I said, you remember about Casino? My God, he said, what are you doing, fighting the war all over again and whatnot? Well, I said, Captain Eaton is here with me, and we're talking about Casino. Oh, my God, we almost, what are you talking about there? I said, Joe, you remember the time we had getting up to, yes, he said, almost got killed, and you were in this and that and the other thing. I said, by the way, do you remember coming down? Big pause. God, he said, come to think of it, no. And then he said, perhaps they left us up there. Never remember. Can't find anybody to tell me how we came down.
Yeah. Where did you go from there?
From Casino?
Yes.
We then moved back to the other coast again, to the East Coast. And there we were in the line all the time, but it was a very quiet...
they call it a static position.
Static position. So we were there...
Holding a front.
Yes.
And we were there pretty well all that fall... All that summer.
That was the summer of 44.
Yeah,
summer of 44. They took Rome on June the 4th, as I recall, and then they invaded Europe on June the 6th.
June 6th, yes.
And on the day of June the 6th, I remember all of the artillery fired smoke shells, which would explode in the air, and the fellows at the guns worked out a program whereby you had a great, big, magnificent V in smoke.
In the sky.
In the sky, over the German lines, There's one group in the artillery, any artillery regiment, but particularly in ours, that have not been recognized, fully, in our view, like they should have been. And these are the fellows who were the so-called signalers, who laid all the land lines from and kept the communications open, whether it be wireless or whether it be by line. But these guys were always in between the guns and the OP, the observation post.
Yeah.
And it was their role to make sure that communications were open constantly, which wasn't always possible. The lines were continually being shelled and broken, and when that happened, whether they were being continually shelled, these signalers had to go on anyway and
repair it
and repair the lines and
find where the break was.
And what they would do, they'd pick up a piece of line either end and go till they met and find the break, and then they'd tie it together again. Yeah.
We had a tremendous, really, liaison with our signalers. The group that we had are very close to us now because they were our lifeline.
Who were some?
Well, French from Gander, Joe Bennett, who's living down in Torbay now, Bob Barnes, who was out in Mount Pearl somewhere, and
Fred Richards.
Lives
up by Monday Pond.
And
you see each other still?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, move us along.
That fall, we got transferred from back to the other side again. Florence, we just stopped there and went across the Arno River, actually, at Florence.
The Arno.
We lost some signalers the other side of the Arno River and mines and whatnot. We were losing the odd fellow here and there, not in our particular party, but...
Anyway, we moved on up through from Florence to a place called Monte Catini, and then...
Monte Catini Alto.
And then Monte Catini Alto was the beginning of the Apennine Mountains. And we went right up through the Apennines, and there we ran into some very bitter but short-range fighting with the Coldstream Guards. We were... then with the Coldstream Guards. And it was really, really bitter. We lost Kelland on that one of those battles.
That ridge.
Alan Goodridge is on the other side of the river.
Fellow like Laurie Brown, your namesake in Gander, he was a signaler with that crew, lost half his hand. Bill Giles won the military medal.
That's right. Alan Goodridge won the MC.
Military cross, and they were right on our right going up through this delaying action.
Now, the Germans were also engaged at this point in defending in northwestern France. The Normandy landings had taken place. Did that mean that your opposition, your enemies in Italy, were diminished in numbers or strength?
We were both diminished in numbers and strength. They withdrew the Canadians and sent them to France. And they withdrew one or two other divisions. I think the Scottish 51st was taken out and put up there.
The guts and bitter fighting of both sides slowed down.
Subsided, yeah.
I see. Did you see any German prisoners during any of this?
Oh, God, yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Did you have any sense from them that they felt perhaps they were losing?
And no. Particularly, we're going back a bit now, but going on the first battle after the over the Sangha River. Remember, we took 17 one morning. And they were
arrogant.
Oh, God. And they were bitter that they'd been taken prisoner.
Yeah.
They were
the officers there, I remember, young officers who were ahead of the tanks, that we'd overrun them and so on. They came in as haughty and arrogant.
It's very interesting, though, to see how one's mind can be controlled. They are the product of the Hitler Youth Program, and it's absolutely fantastic. They're well-trained. Mm. They're fearless. They are well-educated. They're full of energy, and they've got a great desire to achieve, you know? Mm-hmm. And they never lose it.
Yes.
Like
it's
young
amazing.
Crop of young students now, like could be out at Memorial. They're new, they're fired up with some cause, and that's it. The old-timers, the fellows that have been slugging it out through Africa and Sicily and Italy and whatnot, they're a little more, they're subdued, some of these guys, because they've been through it.
Well, they were tired.
They're sweating it out.
Coming up after the regional news and weather, the conclusion of our Remembrance Day special, the end of the war, and the scars and memories they all took home.
Ships
will sail again all over the world. Then we'll have time for things like wedding rings, and free hearts will sing when the lights go on again.
When the lights go on again all over the world.
Just a few yards away, there is a British observation officer. I'll go over to him and see what he has to say about this. Oh, he is just telephoning.
Right, Sergeant. Will you send through the following message? To command post from Rags. Situation report. Full stop. 2-4, 24 tanks have crossed river this morning under fairly continuous shell fire.
You have just heard a recording made on the Sangro River today. This is Matthew Halton of the CBC speaking from Italy.
CBC reporter Matthew Halton knew what it was like to be at the front. So did the hundreds of Newfoundlanders and Labradorians who fought their way across the battlefields of Europe, Africa, and Asia. Today, Harold Lake and Campbell Eaton, veterans of the 166, the Newfoundland Artillery Regiment, have been sharing their memories with us. Let's return to them once more as we look to the end of the war and the memories that remain. Here's Harry Brown.
Okay, we've moved past Florence and we've crossed the Arno River. And we've passed the Monte Cattino Alto and the Apennines. You're in the Apennines with the Coldstream Guards. And it's 1945 now.
Right.
Is it?
And getting up to Christmas now. And
Of 44.
Of 40, 44.
44, yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So we're take us through Christmas, New Year.
One night in the observation post, Harold and I and a couple of others were sitting down, and the discussion was, what are your percentage of chances of surviving? And we put it down in terms of percentage, you know. Well, maybe I had 80% chance after all we'd been through. You know, how often can you go through these things and still win? Anyway, when we finished up with Harold Lake, he had already hit about 125%. So the next morning, I posted Harold back to the guns, said, out. And so he went back to the guns and became a sergeant on the guns.
Okay, but now it's 1944. It's Christmas, New Year's, 1944-45. Yeah. You describe the enemy as being highly trained, highly educated, highly motivated, mm-hmm. indoctrinated politically and philosophically and so on. Hitler Youth.
Yeah.
The training that went from the time that they were 12 years old. Mm. You never saw a uniform until you were 20.
Yeah.
You were civilians, essentially.
Mm.
And so there was that difference.
But we had trained pretty well for, you know, we'd been trained for nearly 5 years. Mm-hmm. We had gone through a pretty rough discipline with a good mm-hmm. colonel, yeah. and the unit became proud of the fact they were good and well-disciplined.
Good.
And with that went to a motivation that was incredible after 5 years. The motivation of this group was absolutely unbelievable. At that stage in the war, you know, I would say our morale was way ahead of anybody that we worked with, way ahead.
How do you account for that?
We were proud of what we were doing, I think.
Mm. But why?
I think it was the training. I think it was the way that Lambert and Hitchcock, our two COs, handled us, motivated us, you know, kept us on top of things, well-trained. We were delighted to be efficient. Mm-hmm. We did a good job. We were pleased with it.
Did you think about Newfoundland?
Yeah.
Of course, we thought of home. When are we going to get home? Geez, we've been over there 5 years.
But Newfoundlanders, if I may say so, can be well-trained. Here was a bunch ragged-ass artillerymen from Newfoundland, if you want to use that expression.
I thought I was describing you earlier on as being that.
But anyway, these men who had no training, sent to England, became a trained, efficient, mobile 25-pound regiment within the ranks of the British Army that were used by the brigadiers and the generals to fill in a gap, which is a tight spot, a dirty job, to do a very efficient job. And that Newfoundland crowd, of which Cam Eaton and I happened to be two only, of an observation party, the gunners, the signalers, the drivers, they were second to none. I say that because I was proud of them. I'm still proud to be associated with them.
It's this January now, 1945.
Can we go back to Christmas?
Of course.
The Christmas before, we were in the line.
Mm, terrible time.
So this Christmas we were supposed to be in, but I made a request that, you know, to the CO that we not be in, that we were entitled to one Christmas day off.
Yes.
So we came back to a rest center, which was the halfway between the observation post and the guns. And there were, as I recall, 16 of us. And there was a range of houses which were in full view, so during the daytime we couldn't go outside because as soon as we did, we'd get shelled. But however, Christmas dinner, Harold came up from the guns to join us for that Christmas dinner.
And they got killed on the way up.
We all got prepared, well prepared for that. And we had a goose, and we had a small pig, and we had the turkey, and we had all kinds of vegetables.
Balloons.
And, I was going to come to that. And then we had our Christmas parcels all arrived from home. We had all sorts of colored paper. We decorated a Christmas tree, and we had lights, you know, from headlights, headlamps on the vehicles, and batteries to keep them lit, and quite a show. And all the colored paper on the trees, and included in that, we had balloons, which we had drawn from the doctor's stores, medical officer's stores,
you know.
Condoms blown up all over the place.
It was a safe Christmas.
No, very safe, very safe. And then we just had, because of the fact we're supposed to be ready to go that night again, we all just had a couple of glasses of wine, which, of course, we got off the local countryside. And I must say, it was quite an impressive day.
Mm.
It really, really was. And then when it was all over, we had nice dishes and everything. And instead of washing the dishes, everybody got around the tablecloth we had. Terrible thing to say now. Dumped all the dishes in, tied a knot in it, and threw it all out the window. At this stage in life, you say, what a bunch.
Yeah.
Let's take us now into the January of 45. Was it still static?
Still static. In fact, it was static right up to the middle to end of February when we were pulled out of the line and they started home leave. And then we had groups, about 50, I guess, Harold,
yeah.
wasn't it?
Yeah.
That were sent home, you know, 2 or 3 or 4 weeks apart with the idea of coming back in. Some of them came back, and Harold and I came home on the same group. We never went back.
I see. So for you and for the regiment, in a sense,
yeah. mm-hmm.
the war ended in February,
in
approximately,
February. That's
45.
Right. That's right.
So you never got into Europe?
No.
It was never intended that we should either, unless we had a big breakthrough, you know.
You came through. You survived the war. You must think about that sometimes.
Quite a lot. Number one, having been through what we went through, to come out of it without any being maimed or hurt in any way on a continuing basis, aging like everybody else is now aging, a few little things may be dragged over from that. But in thinking about it, you know, how fortunate we were, those of us who survived it, to be around. Our war was different than the Englishman's war in the sense that it was an adventure for us. The Englishman's war was that his family was involved, his towns were being bombed, and he was out with us fighting. But ours was an adventure. We didn't have to worry about our families. Our families had to worry about us, maybe. But we went through this thing, and the experience, I think, is one of maturing, understanding people, understanding what discipline is all about. Cannot understand a lot of the nonsense that goes on around us in society today. Never will understand it, because we're all so trained and so disciplined that I think it carries on right to this day, that the way we think, the way we do things, you know, it's a very different approach to life.
Will the rest of us forever be others in your life?
You and I are good friends, but I don't have the same feeling with you as I do, for instance, about Joe Bennett or Cam Eaton or Fred Richards or Bill Oldford or Wilf French, or I could go on. They were the people close to us in our little group in a small part of big battles that slept together, ate together, went to the bathroom together, and nearly died together.
Harry, just looking at a picture here, you know, of there we were, innocent young fellows.
This is your draft. These are all young men in civilian clothes.
Right. And, you know, there's any number of them here. These are all different groups. And there they were, 1940, early 1940. And all of these fellows went over there, went through this thing together. About 45% of them are now died and gone. And they all served, you know, extremely well. Everybody had a job to do, and they did it well. We went over there as a rabble in many, many ways compared to the British Army. And when Lambert took hold of us, he turned us into a team that was second to none.
Would you have been a different person? Did the war change you, Harold?
Yes, it did quite a bit. Yeah, it made, I'd like to think, a better man. I think a great feeling for my fellow man. And to tell me, and to tell you, and to tell anybody listening to this, that war is a horrible, beyond recall experience when you see the slaughter of men and wounded and killed in 19, 20, 22 years of age, buried in a blanket after a bloody big battle of a slaughter in Italy or Africa.
Are you changed, Cam?
Oh, I think yes, very, very considerably. It changed in many, many ways. Number one, I think this kind of exposure for me was one where I really, really learned how to get on with, you know, my fellow man. I think, too, that it gave me an experience that I couldn't buy, I couldn't get it in any other way, of leadership, if you like, understanding how to handle people, and
situations.
Being considerate of the person that's got problems better than ever before. I don't think I could have been the same person.
You got to remember, in Africa, a fellow crawls up by you for shelter, and he's killed, and you survive with a few wounds and whatnot. That haunts you, me. Why him and not me? You know, I live with I've got a lovely three daughters and a family. This man on my left, Cam Eaton, had a tremendous family. And when I see them, of him with his boys and his daughters, I think what almost wouldn't be. I said to my daughter Leslie, that you know, and I said to my wife Robin, who you also know, I said, you know, sometimes I think I got killed in the army, I'm living in another world. They think I'm gone around the bend, and you were looking at me now as if to think I may be gone around the bend. But I do think about it. I was fishing the summer with two of his boys and two of his sons-in-law. And I had a lot of memories fishing on the Gander. They were kind enough to invite me. Mm-hmm. I was delighted to go. We didn't talk about the war too much. But obviously these boys, his sons and sons-in-law, knew that we had a special bond.
A special relationship.
Yes. I was up on the side of the river, and I took out my flask with a drink of scotch, and I had a bottle of beer. And I looked at him, and I looked at his two sons, and I said, boy,
this is different. You got to have a drink with me. And I tossed it back, and one of the sons-in-law came over and said, I think you got a lot of memories between you. He said, I think I'll join you for a drink. Now, that type of thing, you understand?
But, Harry, one of the things, I've never told a story we've told here to my children. Never.
Really?
No.
Why?
Don't know. My father never told me much about World War One.
I have vivid memories of the Army. Vivid memories of terrible ordeals of Africa and Italy that I shall never forget as long as I live. I dwell on it sometimes too much. I think about the guys that didn't come back and how I survived. And I think about perhaps a lot of the guys that we were responsible for killing. You know, they all come in your mind. Your mother teaches you to say your prayers. Thou shalt not kill, and you end up in the army, and your main job, our main job, was killing people and destroying them, or be killed yourself. So it leaves a lot of scars.
You've been listening to a special Remembrance Day edition of On the Go. Our thanks to Harold Lake and Campbell Eden for sharing their memories with us. They are but two of the thousands of men and women who rose to the call. And don't forget on this Remembrance Day to take a moment to think not only of the ones who've gone before, but of the young Newfoundlanders and Labradorians of today who are bearing the bright blue beret of the United Nations forces in war-torn Yugoslavia. Let's hope they all come home safe and sound. We'd like to know what you thought of our Remembrance Day special. Our talkback answering machine is waiting for your call 24 hours a day. The number is 576-5107. My name is Cindy Wall, and this is On the Go.